Diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
The following is a special CJSF presentation that interrupts regularly scheduled programming in this time slot. CJSF 90.1 FM would like to remind listeners that the following program is a repeat broadcast.
I believe in living.
I believe in the spectrum of beta days and gamma people.
I believe in sunshine and windmills and waterfalls. Tricycles and rocking chairs. And I believe that seeds grow into sprouts and sprouts grow into trees.
I believe in the magic of the hands and in the wisdom of the eyes.
I believe in rain and tears and in the blood of infinity. I believe in life.
I believe in life. And I have seen the death parade march through the torso of the earth.
Sculpting mud bodies in this path. I've seen the destruction of the daylight.
And seen bloodthirsty maggots prayed to and saluted. I have seen the kind become the blind.
And the blind become the bind.
In one easy lesson. I have walked on cut glass. I have eaten crow and blunder bread and breathed the stench of indifference.
I've been locked by the lawless, handcuffed by the haters, gagged by the greedy. And if I know anything at all,
it's that a wall is just a wall and nothing more at all.
It can be broken down. I believe in living. I believe in birth.
I believe in the sweat of love and in the fire of truth. And I believe that a lost ship, steered by tired, seasick sailors,
can still be guided home to port.
This program is part three of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors, or Do They? A series of programs about borders, walls, and fences, visible or invisible, that keep us in, keep us out, and keep us divided. Part three focuses on the possibility of a world without walls or borders, and the benefits or problems such a world would bring about. This program is dedicated to anyone prevented from reaching the people or places they love by a border wall.
My name is David Gallup. I'm a human rights lawyer. I'm also president of the World Service Authority, which is the administrative branch of a world citizen government that Gary Davis, who's also was known as World Citizen Number One, had founded back in 1953. I've been with the organization 31 years now. I came in as their chief attorney, but then became president of the organization a few years later. I got to work with Gary Davis for almost 25 years until he died in 2013. So I felt great, you know, it was a great opportunity for me to learn about a different aspect of international law and human rights, working with Gary, understanding the problems and major difficulties that refugees and stateless people or people in those situations find themselves. And of course, now we're trying to carry on the legacy of Gary Davis by promoting world citizenship, world law, and to create the institutions of law that humans need to live together peacefully with each other and sustainably with the earth. I mean, Gary Davis used to like to say, what are the two most important questions of the 21st century? The first is, who are you? The second is, and of course you'd have to answer, I'm a world citizen, because understanding our duty, rights and duties are global or even universal will help us to deal with problems that are global. And many of our problems now, whether it's pandemics, whether it's war and violence, whether it's the environment, these are all global issues that cannot be handled by any one nation state. And then the second question is, how do we ensure survival of humanity in the earth? If the earth dies, we die with it, right? So they are, in that respect, we really cannot easily separate, and we shouldn't separate human and environmental rights. We need to see ourselves, I sort of created a term, human environmental. We are human environmental beings. which we need to realize that we are dramatically linked to the earth on which we temporarily reside. And I think certainly many indigenous populations understand that much better than a lot of people and appreciate their surroundings and their environment. And of course, have been taught for so many years, eons to protect it. Nation states are exclusive. Human and environmental rights, or universal rights, if you want to talk about like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, are inclusive. How can an exclusive entity uphold something that's inclusive? Inherently, it cannot. So our rights as national citizens basically end at the border, because once you leave that so-called country or nation state to go to another part of the planet, that government may be able to protect you if you can reach out to the embassy or consulate, potentially, if you're having some issues in another part of the world. But then you become sort of duty bound to whatever rights regime is established in another part of the world. And right now, 60% of the world's population lives in Asia, which does not yet have a regional human rights system. So this is why Gary Davis, who became stateless, who gave up his U.S. citizenship, coming from the so-called first world, he had the privilege, in a sense, of giving it up. He wasn't forced into that situation back in 1948. But he realized that as a world citizen, or I like to call him world full rather than stateless, because stateless is a negative. But I call him world full because he had an appreciation of the world as one, the world as a unified ecosystem and community that humans have, of course, an impact on. And he was an appreciation and love for the world. But so a world system would be much better at affirming our rights and duties, no matter where we find ourselves. In a world that we're trying to create, which would mean that world citizenship is a recognized legal status everywhere in the world, it would effectively end statelessness. Because if you, as a world citizen, have all of your rights respected, not just a modicum or minimum of rights, like the right maybe to work or to reside, but all of your rights, the right to vote, the right to participate in government, no matter where you find yourself on planet Earth. I know when I was a little kid and I went to elementary school, I had to put my hand on my heart and I had to say the Pledge of Allegiance. That's an inculcation of an ideology of a citizenship, right? So we're trying to do the same thing. We actually have a world flag. We have, a world passport, which is, these are documents of identification and travel that will allow us to identify as world citizens. We register people as world citizens, and that you can do at our website, worldcitizengov.org. So it's easy for people to start understanding this, but it does become complex because we are so, I can't think of another word other than brainwashed, to think from a national perspective, that's like the most we can be as humans is a national citizen. We're not taught from when we're young to think of ourselves as citizens of the world, but we're trying to change that. The world passport has been recognized by 96% of all countries in the world by them placing visa, entry, and exit stamps in the world passport. So the majority of countries in the world have recognized it. There are six countries that have officially recognized it, which are Burkina Faso, Ecuador, Mauritania, Tanzania, Togo, and Zambia. And then, like I said, all the other countries have recognized it, and many continue to do so on a case-by-case basis. But as a lawyer, I always like to provide a caveat, and that is to say that although the World Passport is a valid, recognized, and legal document affirming the right to freedom of travel and the right to identification that has been reaffirmed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is actually a binding treaty on almost all governments in the world have signed and ratified that treaty, even though it has this valid legal status, does not mean it is always recognized. And we never want anyone to have a false expectation that it will always be recognized. In fact, this is why I came to World Service Authority back in 1992, was to open up WSA's legal department so that we would have a legal advocacy team that could back up the validity of the documents when people are trying to exercise their right to travel, especially someone in a refugee or stateless situation who maybe this is the only document in the world that they can get. They can't get any other. So anyway, the point is we do have fundamental universal rights that should always be respected. And unless someone's harming somebody, they should always be able to exercise their right to travel where they want to on planet Earth. It's it's everyone's planet. When you're going from one part of the planet to another, you're not leaving one place to another, especially if my country is the world then you're just going to another part of your country, which is the world. A few years back, there was a group of Ogoni refugees, and there's Ogoni refugees who were living in Ogoni land in Nigeria, but many of them who fled to Benin, the neighboring country, because of the digging for oil in that country, in Nigeria, that really destroyed their homeland, made it uninhabitable. Okay, so we gave away almost between 1,000 and 1,500 free, for which for us was a lot at that time, passports to these people who were living in the refugee camp. So to help them either on a day-to-day basis to identify themselves so they could leave the camp even for a short time during the day to work, or maybe to go to another country to find a safe haven outside of the refugee camp. And having the document, obviously having a document is better than having no document. If you have nothing, it's almost as if you don't exist. Our ultimate goal is world peace and justice in the end, right? So, and how are we doing that? Through education, promotion, and implementation of human and environmental rights, world citizenship, world law, and as I said, creating those institutions of law that would help humans live together peacefully with each other and sustainably with the earth. Well, I think that one of the first concerns people have, especially about a world government, is that it's just such a big, complex framework. How would you make that work? There's so many different cultures and religions and viewpoints around the world. How would we ever make that work? So that's certainly a legitimate concern that people have, the complexity of it. And, you know, the cop-out answer that Gary Davis would give would be, I'm just here to say that we need to start identifying ourselves as world citizens, and then we can figure it out, because 7 billion heads working together are better than one, right? Or 8 billion. I guess we're up to 8 billion people now, right? Gary Davis would love to say, peace is not the absence of war. Peace is the presence of law. If we can put down, even for a while, hopefully, or forever, obviously, our armaments, our weapons, both locally with all the guns that are making me sick, as well as the tanks and the nuclear weapons, if we can put those down and say, well, why fight and die for a country? Why not love and live for humanity and the earth? The biggest concern is people see how nation states don't function. So they can't even imagine how can a world system function. We're so caught up in the current system that it's so hard to imagine beyond it. It's just like the silkworm that is in its cocoon. It can't imagine that when it comes out of the cocoon, it's going to be this beautiful butterfly, right? So we can't imagine in our national cocoon that we could come out and be a world citizen butterfly.
Was fortunate enough to get a job with AMNEES, which is an American government outreach program to people, in this instance, to the Palestinians, to help them upgrade their language skills in English and maybe potentially apply for a Fulbright scholarship. And I had numerous groups of students. This particular group was a group of hospital employees and included physicians, radiologists, lab techs, nurses, nursing assistants. I would go to Makassar to the hospital twice a week and have classes with them. Well, it happened on this particular day that there was some incident in East Jerusalem, and unbeknownst to me, there was a blockade. And so I was driving from our home and got as far as the Damascus Gate when a very young Israeli soldier stopped me. And he had no English, and I had about three words of Hebrew. And he's giving me a signal that I could not go any further. Well, the hospital's on the other side of the city of East Jerusalem, and I'm at the Damascus Gate. And I just kept saying to him, Makassid, 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 for about 5 minutes. And finally, he got disgusted with me, and he said, okay, go. Not in English, but he signaled for me to go. Well, all the main routes were pretty well blocked off, but by this time, I had a little familiarity with the city, and so I went all the back routes. And I was about 15 minutes late for my class, and all my students were there waiting. And I went in, I said, you know, I apologize. I'm sorry I'm late, but there was a blockade. And one of the doctors said to me, we know.
Katja Hoyer is a German-British historian, journalist, and the author of the widely acclaimed Blood and Iron, a visiting research fellow at King's College London and a fellow of the Royal Historical Society. She is a columnist for the Washington Post and hosts the podcast The New Germany together with Oliver Moody. She was born in East Germany and is now based in the UK.
My inspiration for writing Beyond the Wall is twofold, really. One is a very personal curiosity about East Germany. I was born in that state in 1985, but I was only a small child when the Berlin Wall fell, 4 years old, really, so I haven't got very many memories myself of the state that I was born into. So I'm in a peculiar situation where you look at my birth certificate and it says the name of a country on it that doesn't exist anymore. And so there's always been a degree of, me looking back and wanting to know really what that country was like that I was born into and that I never experienced as an adult. From the perspective of a professional historian, there's also an academic interest in the subject matter. I've felt for a long time that the history of Germany is told in a very one-sided way. Outside of Germany, many people have got a very sort of cliched view of what East Germany was like, almost like a cartoonish, world where spies roam around in long sort of grey coats. And I was trying to write a book that gives the complexity of the history of East Germany some justice and just creates a more complex and more comprehensive view of the state that lay beyond it, beyond the wall really that it's normally associated with, and also beyond the security apparatus, the Stasi, that it is perhaps most famous or infamous rather for. So those were my two motivations, both a personal one and a professional one. My book is about the entire history of East Germany, of the German Democratic Republic. And the state was founded in 1949 and the Berlin Wall was only built in 1961. Many people forget that, but actually the state spent the first 12 years of its existence without the Berlin Wall at its heart. So the main thing that I'm trying to highlight is really, first of all, that there's a long history of German communism and socialism before East Germany is founded, and most of the people involved in that process had been communists all their lives and had been waiting for the supposedly inevitable world revolution that Marx had promised them almost a century earlier. And so, you know, this is one reason why they sort of press ahead with the build-up of socialism so vehemently and so in such a blinkered way, even though it's clearly detrimental to the economy of the young GDR, because they see it as their one and only chance to build a socialist state on German soil that they've been dreaming about for such a long time. Most of these German communists fled Germany when Hitler came into power. So with the crackdown that happened immediately under Hitler on German communists and socialists, many of them decided that now was the time to go to the Soviet Union for shelter on the one hand side, but also because in their minds they'd sort of built it up to sort of this utopian idea of the society that they sought to create. And when they arrive in the Soviet Union, they quickly find that actually this kind of utopia doesn't exist, and in fact it's very dystopian. And Stalin becomes very paranoid and imagines that these sort of thousands of communists, German communists, that have now arrived in the Soviet Union might be spying for Hitler. They might be some sort of fifth column for Nazi Germany. And so he starts cracking down on them hard during the purge years of the 1930s. And the vast majority of them don't survive that. And you can imagine what this does to someone's mindset, constant paranoia, people denouncing one another to save their own lives. You can't trust anybody. Everybody's constantly kind of got it in for you. So it's a mindset where when these people go back to Germany, they find it very, very hard to trust their own population. And even one another. Basically, we tend to imagine East and West Germany almost as sort of mirror images of one another. We tend to think of them as kind of black and white capitalist communists, and therefore sort of equally sized states with similar starting conditions, and that just wasn't the case. So first of all, West Germany was much bigger than East Germany, had a much bigger population, was bigger in terms of its landmass. It also had most of the sort of industrial heartlands, particularly the Ruhr region, which was in the far west of Germany, which is where the sort of coal and iron and everything else that was needed for Germany's industry was located, whilst the east was actually fairly agrarian and flat and sort of without much by way of natural resources. Well, in socialist doctrine, the idea is that women should be equal to men and therefore have a full role to play in the socialist society, and the state set about trying to achieve that very early on. So childcare is being built up very quickly despite a sort of struggle to provide the facilities and the labour for that, and women are encouraged and girls are encouraged in school to basically pick up apprenticeships, go to university and live a full working life, and that was quite revolutionary for the time, and it did lead to a situation where the vast majority of women worked in full-time employment by the end of the 1980s. Over 90% of women were in full-time employment, and that's the highest rate ever achieved, as far as I know, in human history.
Well, like West Germany and many other countries at the time, the East Germany was no exception in that it was also not a particularly pleasant place for people that we would now call LGBT to live, in the sense that society was still very prejudiced towards them, particularly also the sort of socially quite conservative elite. And I think what the GDR was also lacking in comparison to Western countries perhaps is an ability to form sort of subcultures or, you know, have clubs and communities set up as a means of living the sort of life that people wanted to lead outside of mainstream culture. That was more difficult to do because in the GDR that automatically made you quite suspicious to the authorities, even though it may not have been a political reason. In the sort of early phases, so before the Berlin Wall was built, many of the people that arrived from East Germany to West Germany in refugee camps and other sort of institutions that were set up to take that huge influx of people said when they arrived there, and they were surveyed on this, that it was living conditions that lifestyle choices that made them leave East Germany and seek their fortunes in the West. And this was largely to do with the fact that the early GDR in particular tried to set up a sort of classic socialist society in the sense that it was classless and therefore didn't really allow above average as well as below average sort of lifestyles and forms of income, and therefore of course squashed ambition. And so people who were well trained or middle class or had, you know, had a university education, intellectuals and so on, they quite often left to seek their fortunes in West Germany. Later on, many people, especially in the 1980s, felt that the state was becoming more oppressive, and that there were increasingly also political and sort of social reasons and psychological reasons why many people wanted to leave, rather than just economic and financial. And that is to do with the fact that when the Berlin Wall was built in 1961, there was an understanding that the sort of trade-off for that, now that people had been locked in, would be that life was made sort of worth living. It would be, there would be reform, there would be change. And for a while it looked as though that was the case, and many people arranged themselves with the system that they now lived on in. It was quite telling that you don't get any sort of large-scale uprisings in the 60s and 70s. Despite the fact that the Berlin Wall was built, despite all of that, there's a feeling in the 80s that none of that is forthcoming. And so by that point, you've got fairly high living standards, the highest in the Eastern Bloc and the communist world. People are, of course, not sort of in the same situation as they are, say, in West Germany, but they do have, you know, food on the table, nobody's starving, they've got fixed jobs, there isn't unemployment, they're relatively well housed at that point. And importantly, they are also well educated. The GDR creates one of the most literate societies in the world at that point. People read a lot. And so, you know, the GDR basically creates a confident, well-read, highly politicized and well-fed society that sits there and says, and now what? And that now what doesn't lead anywhere in the 1980s, where the regime seems incredibly intransigent and calcified and runs out of ideas. And this is easy to forget, but it's still run by people who were really dinosaurs at that point. Initially, many people who were on the streets in 1989, in the autumn before the Berlin Wall fell, and were asking for the freedom to travel and for reform, there wasn't really even then a sense that it would lead to a reunited Germany. So this is right up until the wall falls in the autumn of 1989. And even once the wall had fallen, many people were still arguing that there could be some sort of German federation of two different countries, where each of the two countries would retain some sort of sense of sort of separate culture and a political system. I think that was unrealistic at that point, because basically the moment you take the Berlin Wall away, you end up very much with the same issue that was there before the wall was put up in 1961, namely you'd get a brain drain, you'd get people leaving very quickly who would do better in a capitalist system, and they'd go. I think the bigger issue really is that there was from the beginning an understanding that, and I described this in the book, an understanding that the West had a system that it liked and that it felt it worked for it. And East Germany started off under the sort of presumption that it wanted to join that system rather than merging the two Germanies together. So in that respect, the term sort of unification is a little bit misleading, because it implies that two countries were merged together into like a bigger, perhaps new thing. And that's not what happened. Basically, East Germany was in effect annexed, but it was willingly annexed, and that's important to highlight as well, in the sense that people voted in 1990 in the first free elections that they've had really for decades, that they voted for parties that argued for quick reunification. But I'm not sure everybody understood at the time that meant almost a complete eradication of everything that they knew, and that was quite a disconcerting moment for many, many people, even those people who felt liberated and freed by the fall of the Berlin Wall. Many still felt it was an odd situation to be in, to have your entire country dissolve around you, your way of life, the way that you did things, and it was disorientating. And it also meant that there was a certain arrogance, and many say that there still is a certain arrogance from West Germans towards former East Germans who sort of feel that they know better, they can do things better